You're listening to Trek FM.
There was a little bar in Mill Valley where all the Starfleet trainees used to go.
The 602 Club.
You know it.
I was there more times than I can remember.
The attempt on my life has left me scarred and deformed. But I assure you, my resolve has never been stronger.
In order to ensure the security and continuing stability, the Republic will be reorganized into the First Galactic Empire for a safe and secure society.
So this is how liberty dies, with thunderous applause.
Welcome, everyone, to Trek FM's local watering hole. I hope that you have got something great from Ruby. I'm really excited. We're going to be talking about Star Wars Episode 3 this week, and it's going to be just a blast finishing out the prequels before we jump into the original trilogy soon and heading all the way towards Episode 7 there in December. Before we do that, I want to remind everybody, of course, that the 602 Club is part of Trek FM, which is an entire network of podcasts devoted to Star Trek and beyond. That's right. You can find us on iTunes.com/Trek FM. We are a feature provider there on iTunes. Very proud to be that. And of course, we're also on Stitcher, TuneIn, Spreaker, SoundCloud, Windows Phone. You can find us on our website at trek.fm. You can grab the RSS link there, and you can also stream and download the MP3 file from the website. So many ways to listen. And of course, there on iTunes, when you're there, make sure you do give us a star rating and review, because I'd really like to be able to give away to you a $50 Amazon gift card, as well as the USS Eagle Moss Vengeance that my friend Norman will be giving to the winner as well. That contest is running through the beginning of October, so you have all of September to get those reviews in and have them show up. We are trying to reach as many reviews as possible. We would love to hit the number of reviews, which would be 100. That's what we're going for, what we're shooting for. We're shooting high, and so right now, we are at 25 written reviews, so I really appreciate all the people who have been going out there and doing that. I want to give a shout-out to Odo, could be that chair, as well as Christopher Settle and Dead Columbo. Thank you all for your 5-star written reviews there on iTunes. We really appreciate that. It helps out the show greatly. And, of course, you all are entered into our contest. Well, guys, I have amazing guests back with me. They are going to be rounding out the prequel trilogy here with me, and that is Bruce Gibson. Bruce, welcome back into the 602.
Thank you for having me back once again, and thank you for saying we're amazing guests. That's just a little much there. I'm kind of blushing right now. But that may be because Ruby's serving drinks tonight, and she gave me what she calls the drink special Greedo Shot First, which is a bit of peppermint and bell pepper pieces in the drink, and it's kind of nasty, but it works.
I've told her to stop experimenting with the drinks, because I don't want pepper in my, anyway. Goodness. You can always tell her just to get you a nice scotch or something. Just tell her it's on me this time. Okay. John Mills, welcome back into the 602. How are you?
Hello. I'm glad to be back. I'm glad to see that my chair was left dusty. Ruby's really got to work on the housekeeping here. I'm just going to throw that out there right now. So, please.
Well, no, really, John, it was just the fact that she won't let anybody else sit in that chair.
Oh, well, okay.
She doesn't even touch it until you get back here, because she wants to make sure that it's completely contoured to yourself.
So. That's true. It does take me some time to work the groove back in if it gets touched. That's true.
Well, guys, we started something fun when we were doing the first two films in the series here and talking about our experience with the different films. And so I'm kind of wondering for you guys, because each of us have had an interesting story, what is your episode three experience? What about you, Bruce?
It's a strange experience for me because I don't exactly remember seeing this movie that first time, exactly what theater, or which is really strange because I remember in detail seeing the first Star Wars in 77, and then in 80, 83, and then 99, 2002. But for some reason with 2005, I can't remember exactly precisely what I was doing, or but I know I would have been with my wife. I think I remember which theater it was, but I will say what I do remember is when I left the theater, I thought, okay, if I were to die tomorrow, I can say I've seen every Star Wars movie. The saga is complete. And then a couple years ago, I realized
the circle is now complete.
The circle is not complete because more movies are coming. So I need to live a little longer.
Yes, we want you to live a very long time, Bruce.
Well, if Disney keeps making films, I'll live a long, long time.
Oh, well, we figured out the secret to immortality then, is Disney buying Lucasfilm. This is going to keep us all alive.
If only they would have told Anakin that. That's how you keep people alive.
Oh, my gosh. Well, awesome. Maybe, Bruce, you weren't on any kind of medication at that point, and that's why you just can't quite remember what happened in, you know, where you were when you saw the movie?
I think because, I don't know. I was not on any medication except for, like, cholesterol medicine, but that wouldn't affect anything.
Okay. Well, maybe it was just so mind-blowing, the experience, that it literally blew those memories out of the water.
Actually, I think in some ways, you might be a little right in the fact that I knew this was the end, and so I kind of had mixed emotions.
Mm. Sure. Mm. Sure. That makes sense. Well, the story of the prequels, I was at a different stage in my life. Everyone that came out, by the time this came out, I had gotten married and I was actually on a business trip down in Louisville, Kentucky, of all places. And I had made a declaration that hell and high water couldn't keep me away from seeing this on opening night at midnight. And so even though I was on a business trip and everybody else was going out to, like, you know, business dinners and, you know, staff dinners and having fun, my wife flew down to Louisville and joined up with me and a guy from the Convention and Visitors Bureau. And I can't remember his name. Anyway, and he went with us to the midnight showing. Because he knew he lived there, so he knew the movie theater. He was able to get the tickets and everything. And we went in and watched the midnight showing in Louisville, Kentucky. And I can tell you that I have no trouble admitting this. I cried, that I recall, twice during the movie. I got a little misty at the beginning because it was the feeling of, oh gosh, this is it. This is the last time I'm going to be in a movie theater seeing this for the first time, you know? And then at the end, like, I'd been so moved, and then also realizing again, it's over. Like, I was emotionally spent at the end of it. So I can't remember the name of the movie theater, but I can tell you that it wasn't stadium seating. It was an old style rake audience seating arrangement. We were about three quarters back, a little off center. And it was over before I realized it had begun. I will always remember that night because, trust me, my wife scored a lot of points for going to those lengths to make sure she was there with me for the midnight showing. That's dedication right there, gents.
That's a winner. Yeah. That's, you know, you got a good woman when she's willing to fly down on your business trip just so you can see the movie together.
Yeah, it was pretty cool.
Well, you know, at that point in my life, it changed as well. I was in a different stage, and I was, you know, working and everything, and working at an insurance agency in Dallas, and a couple of the other guys that were there with me, they were all big fans, and we were planning to go to the movie together up where I had seen the movie before for episode 2, where I'd gone 6 times in 1 day, but we were just going to go to the midnight showing. And of course, 2005 is the last time people really, you know, camped out for films, so there were fans of that theater who had been there for, you know, weeks and weeks. And there were tents set up and everything. Well, our boss let us go early that day, so we went and got in line. When we got there about, I guess a little after noon, the line was already around the building.
Wow.
And so standing in line for 10 hours in the Texas sun to see, you know, episode 3, I had, by that point, I had my Obi-Wan lightsaber hilt from Master Replicas. I was wearing it that day. I felt so cool. There were raffles going on, fans having just a great time, and it was one of those things where it's just, it was like kind of being at a con where you're all just celebrating, and yeah. It was just such a fun atmosphere. And then, you know, we finally got let into the theater, you know, 9 hours later, and there's a big party going on. They're doing the raffle drawing, and I'm still so mad at myself to this day. If I had spent one more dollar, one more ticket number, I would have won the Force Effects Darth Vader lightsaber.
Oh.
Yeah.
And I'm still so mad at myself. I'm like, one freaking dollar stood between me and a Force Effects lightsaber. So that's, yeah, that was my experience. Surrounded by fans, people that were willing to stand in line for 10 hours or more to see the movie. And, you know, when you're just surrounded by that kind of excitement and love, you can't have a bad experience. And you know, I'm with you guys. It was an emotional, for me, it was an emotional thing to see and to watch finally play out. And I think we all kind of hit on, and the end, I mean, and I say that as a question because we all thought it was the end, but yeah. It's not, but it was, but it's not, but it was, but it's not.
Yeah.
And so I wanted to ask you, though, because this is the end of Anakin Skywalker. I mean, this is the fulfillment of that part of the Skywalker saga. How do you think that this wrapped it up for you? You know, we'd all grown up with the original trilogy. We'd all seen what happened to Darth Vader. We just didn't know completely how he got there. How do you feel like this for you, sitting with it for so long now? How did it, and how does it wrap up this part of the saga?
I think this movie fulfilled what I needed to see in wrapping up Anakin Skywalker's story. And that's coming from seeing episode 1 and 2. And really, in a lot of ways, it wrapped it up the way I was expecting after seeing those two films. But prior to the prequel trilogy, I had different ideas about Anakin Skywalker, which I think a lot of people did. When we saw Anakin as an old man and as a Force ghost in Return of the Jedi, I think we had different visions, different interpretations of what the Clone Wars was going to be like. So when the prequel trilogy came out, especially The Phantom Menace, it really, I think, threw a lot of fans off, because that's not what they were envisioning. That's not what they were picturing. But once you saw those first two, episode 1 and 2, those films, then seeing Anakin in episode 3, him being portrayed as the hero of the Clone Wars that we saw in the beginning, and then his fall was maybe a little too quick. But, you know, you only have a two and a half hour long movie. It worked for me. It really was, it felt right.
I agree. It it did feel right. It does feel right. And in terms of, I'm glad you brought up the quick turn, because I, not necessarily the first time I watched it, but probably the second or third time I watched it, I realized that Anakin's turn doesn't happen when we all think it does. And I don't know if Lucas did that on purpose. I don't know if that was his intent or whatever. But the way I read the film and the way I read it, you know, after the second or third time, was Anakin's fall is either when he kills Dooku in the beginning, or it actually happened back when he killed all the Tuskens. And so the film isn't a march of a good man into evil. It's the march of an evil man who remembers he's supposed to be good, and he's struggling with it through the whole thing. Like, he doesn't want to admit who he has become. And that's why when he gets that excuse from Palpatine, like that turn in the Galactic Opera House is like, that scene is such a linchpin scene. I mean, obviously it's constructed as such. I'm not like blowing anybody's mind with that, but for me, textually, it's really Anakin hearing that he has an excuse to do what, to embrace who he has become. So, you know, I mean, that's my reaction, you know, in detail to that. But, you know, that's just sort of like where the film sits for me.
Well, I'm glad you brought up the Tusken Raiders, because I was thinking that exact same thing. When I saw Attack of the Clones, that scene with the Tusken Raiders, I stepped out of that wondering, is he already on the dark side, or does he just have a step in? He's not fully in, but maybe he's halfway in. And you're right. It's if you put those two films together, the turn to the dark side doesn't seem as abrupt. When you look at Revenge of the Sith alone, you may be looking at that as, oh, he's totally on the light side of the Force, and all of a sudden, boom, he's going to the dark. No, he's already been going down that path. He's already on his way. We're just seeing the end of that journey.
Right.
And I think that is the reason. And it really brought to light the truth of Yoda saying, you know, once you start down the dark path, forever will it dominate your destiny.
Yeah.
And so Anakin starting on the dark path in episode 2 and then finding a way, I think he finds an outlet in the Clone Wars. And I would say, John, that if we're going to talk about when the fall is, that it would be when Palpatine gives him the excuse to take Dooku's life, and he struggles with the idea of it not being the Jedi way, because there still is that part of him that says, I should be better than this, but that's exactly why he has the conversation then later with Padme of saying, I'm not the Jedi I should be. I want more. And I think that he's already chosen to take more. He's just still frustrated that there's a piece of morality that's holding him back. And I think it actually is, I think it's one, what Padme will think of him. And two, I think it may be Obi-Wan. And it's not until he's able to rationalize Obi-Wan as being the bad guy, the Jedi being the bad people, that he can truly, fully rationalize in his mind the decision he's made, that he's vindicated by killing all the Jedi and even Obi-Wan, because they've all turned against him. Don't you turn against me too. And so you're either with me or against me. You know, that's the argument. And Obi-Wan says, look, Jedi don't deal in absolutes, which means I still want to be your friend. I want you to come back. But if you're going to make that choice, then my only choice is I have to put a stop to this kind of evil.
Yeah, but see, the thing is, I think that Sith, more than any other of the films, has actual subtext to it. Like, the majority of them, you know, there's stuff that you can read into it. There's symbolism. I'm not taking that away. But I think that sometimes what throws some people with the movie is that Anakin isn't telling the audience, like his words don't, he's actually disseminating. He's not saying what he means. And so I think that his whole, you know, you're with me or against me, I'll bring justice, you know, and, you know, dealing in absolutes and everything. It's not even that he can even be talked to. He's just talking. He's just waiting for, again, the excuse to go after Obi-Wan, you know, but I think that the subtext really plays into that too.
Well, this is a very confusing time in the galaxy with all the events that are taking place. And when Palpatine tells Anakin to kill Dooku, and of course, as you mentioned, that's not the Jedi way, but here's Anakin looking at someone who at that point he thinks is true and honest and good is telling him to commit something that is bad. And maybe this action that he thinks is bad really is good. If you throw in Dark Disciple, the Christy Golden novel, into this mix now, where the Jedi are saying we must kill Dooku, yet again, Anakin is talking to people who are righteous and good who are saying we must kill. There are so many mixed messages between Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith and all throughout the Clone Wars animated series to Anakin that what is right and what is wrong is becoming blurred, and it's almost just go with what you're feeling. And the Jedi helped push him in that direction. He went with his feelings, which took him to the dark side.
There are two things that I want to follow up on with that. Touching on the feeling thing, that's great, because I'm glad you brought that up, because that goes all the way back to episode one. Qui-Gon actually tells him, you know, not to think, to feel, when he's in the pod race. So, like, there's that setup right there. And so is this the logical extension of, you know, he is just doing, he's just following his feelings. But additionally, with the whole killing Dooku, you know, it's wrong, it's not the Jedi way. Yet, even without Dark Disciple, the Jedi then send Obi-Wan out to go, you know, murder Grievous. You know, there's no, don't capture Grievous, don't bring him back. Just, you know, go out, wipe him out, and then the war is over. And so there, you know, within the text of the film itself, there's that whole mixed message from the Jedi themselves about what is right and what is wrong.
I think, though, that the argument in Anakin's head with Dooku is that he's unarmed. That was the frustration, that he had disarmed
literally.
Him. He wasn't a threat anymore. He can kill him at any moment. They can take him into custody and he can stand trial. And that's what's happening in that scene. So that's why he's having such a frustration. And that's where I kind of think, yes, Dark Disciple adds a little bit of gray area to that. But at the same time, Grievous, like Dooku, is the military leader of this organization, and taking them out will put an end to the war. So for Jedi, that should be anathema. But they've fallen down this slippery slope to where that they can rationalize doing that. They've come in so far from their morals. So I think there is a big difference, and that's what Anakin is struggling with, because it truly isn't the Jedi way. Once you have somebody surrendered, you don't stab them in the back, basically, or chop their head off. That's not what you do, you know. So which plays then into the rest of the film, where, you know, when Mace says basically the same thing back to him that Palpatine says about, no, just kill him, he's too dangerous to be left alive. You know, I think you're right on, Bruce, that in the end, Anakin basically, I think, just makes the decision to do what he wants to do. Take the power for himself so he can save Padme, so that he can do what he wants to do. He's tired of everybody telling him what to do, so, and everybody's not being necessarily truthful on either side. They're saying one thing and doing another, so screw all of that. I'm just going to do what I want to do, which is, one, save Padme, and if that means that I have to serve the Dark Lord of the Sith, I don't care anymore. You know what I'm saying?
But see, this is where I question Anakin's motivation. I don't think Anakin really is invested in Padme as much as everybody believes. You know, I think we talked about it on the previous episode. Like, he's really just looking, you know, when he quote unquote falls in love with her, it's more that he's looking to replace a hole in his heart that his mother's death left, et cetera, et cetera. But I think that, you know, even more than that, Padme, again, is an excuse for him. I don't think that there is a desire to save her, but not as strong as we would think. And going back and looking back at the movie, there's actually something that jumped out at me, because right now we're expecting our third child, and something that jumped out at me as I was reexamining things is when Anakin has his nightmare and Padme comes to him and says, you know, what was your dream about? And he says, you die in childbirth. And Padme's first reaction is to grab her belly and say, and the baby. And Anakin is sort of dismissive. He's like, I don't know. And then he turns it back into talking about her. And he says, I'm not going to lose you the way I lost my mother. So it's not even a motivation of love. It's a fear of loss, you know, which again speaks to what Yoda says, I think, in the very next scene, where, you know, Yoda says it's the shadow of greed. Death is normal. You can't, you know, you can't let your fears get a hold of you here. But, like, I don't know. It just jumped out to me this time that even back at that point, it's not that Anakin has this noble motivation to save Padme because he loves her. He has this other motivation paired with it of he just doesn't want to feel out of control of things again.
Oh, I think that's a huge aspect here of control versus trusting in the Force. You know, Anakin has never learned that. He's only learned to use the Force to do what he tells it to do. He's never thought of it in the terms that Qui-Gon thinks of it, or that Obi-Wan or Yoda think of it. That's not how I think Anakin always saw his leaving, and as he grew up in you know, learning the Jedi ways from Obi-Wan, as a way of never not being in control of his own life again. He was never going to be a slave again. We see that clearly in the Clone Wars, the trouble he still has with slavery. And I think it's a control issue for Anakin. And, you know, he works to control every single part of his life. And part of that is Padme. And I do think it's a possessive, greedy, controlling love that, should we call it love? Well, I don't really have another word for it. But it is a greed. And it's interesting because, you know, that's one of the main themes throughout the entire prequel trilogy, is how greed in every single aspect of life slowly undermines every single part of this society to turn it into an empire. And it's the greed of Anakin, and it's the greed of the senators, it's the greed of the Trade Federation, it's the greed of the Sith, it's the greed of everyone.
Don't forget the greed of Watto.
The greed of Watto, exactly. Yeah. So I completely agree with you, John. I think that Anakin is one of those people in this position, especially because he's the quote-unquote chosen one to take advantage of the situation and to be able to get this far without anybody truly questioning him until the very end, when, you know, obviously Obi-Wan and Mace and Yoda are sitting there talking about it on the transport as he's about to go off. Yoda's about to go off to Kashyyyk. They're talking about, isn't he the chosen one? And they're just now realizing we may have fracked up. We could have misread this prophecy, and he might not actually be the chosen one.
Which is a whole conversation in and of itself.
It is a whole conversation. That's a whole podcast that we'll have to do one day. I think it just, as you were talking about, the subtext, the depth, everything that's going on here, the prequels are so full of it. Lucas is just jam-packing this series with so much to think about that I think people turned it off. And I will say this, and it might people might hate me for it, but the OT is not full of that. It's a much simpler story, yeah, with a lot less themes, and the themes are much more fairy tale than I think they are truly in the prequels, where George is dealing with a lot of personal things that he's seeing going on. And so I wanted to ask you guys, what are some of those things that you see kind of Lucas working through here, the messages that were important to him that he's trying to get people to think about? And do you think that that's truly different than what you saw from the original trilogy?
Bruce, if I can jump in, with episode three, I'm going to state flat out, it's my favorite one of the six that currently exist. I know that that might seem like apostasy to other Star Wars fans, but I think it is.
It's Empire!
Yeah, I know, right? Burn me at the stake. Exile me to Hoth. But
we'll send you to Dagobah instead.
That's not so bad. I got some good stew over there. But
that is true. The,
yeah, root leaf. But this is, I maintain, Lucas's most personal film. And I believe that this Revenge of the Sith is a long overdue, for lack of a better word, apology to Marcia. Because you see in this movie somebody who was treated as a wonder child, who had great success, who let it go to his head, who became, by the end, trapped by the machine, by his own decisions, and alienated from everybody around him, and living but very broken and spiritually dead. And I do think that Revenge of the Sith very much is Lucas admitting to Marcia after all of those years, I think I had something to do with the divorce too. And I acknowledge now, I really think he was working out something very, very personal with Sith.
Wow, that haven't thought about that before. So Anakin is George Lucas. That's because his divorce ended right after Return of the Jedi, wasn't it?
They were actually keeping it quiet, but during post production, they had started separation proceedings.
Yeah, so it was right when he was finishing these three films that was taking up all his time. And he was, in a sense, almost like at that time, considered the chosen one of movie making. He was on this huge pedestal. And, he had to put his marriage and his family on the back burner. But he was always making promises that he was going, once this was done, he was going to be there. He was going to be full time, but it was a little, it was just too much too late. And I'm trying, and I'm talking through this as I'm thinking about the film. It's almost, Anakin's kind of doing the same thing. He's even promising Padme at the end, we will rule the galaxy together. Just give me the time, give me the space to make these things happen. But it was, again, too little too late.
I think, looking at the prequel trilogy, and specifically with Sith, I do think that, George definitely had some political messages in the original trilogy, and there's the wonderful themes of the character arcs that he has, these mythic arcs that, so Joseph Campbell in the end. But there's something that's interesting, I think, about the prequel trilogy, because there still is that influence of that Joseph Campbell-ness to things, and yet it's not so clear-cut. And it makes everything a little bit murkier, because the heroes become the villains that become the heroes, and that's one of the reasons that George said, he opened up with the crawl, that there are heroes on both sides here, and that war isn't just clear cut and dry all the time of, there's a good side, there's a bad side. Not, unfortunately, every war isn't World War II, where it can clearly say, you're Nazi, and that's okay. You know, you're bad, completely bad. There's nothing redeeming about you or taking you out. That just doesn't happen all that often. And so, and it, clearly, too, I mean, this war that is one that's been manufactured. And so there are heroes on both sides because the reasons, and we even see this in the film, Padme kind of coming around saying, what if we're the very thing that we were fighting against, you know, realizing that maybe it's all a sham, maybe it's a lie. So, I mean, the depth here, I think, is fantastic. And I think the reason that this movie did so well, obviously, at the box office and got the, you know, 80% of Rotten Tomatoes is this is the film, I think, when people came, and this is the prequel trilogy, I kind of think everybody thought that every film was going to be like Episode 3.
Yeah. I think that's
So when that wasn't the case with Episode 1 and they got Goofy Jar Jar, Goofy, that's right. Oh, gosh, there, Mickey. You know, that's not exactly, sorry there, Goofy. Didn't mean to bump into you there. Yeah, I think that's, they just didn't expect that to be a part of this new trilogy. What they expected was the dark, gritty Episode 3. Everything is about, the entire three films is about Anakin being trained and falling. And that's not where Lucas wanted to go with the story. That's not what he had envisioned. And so, you know, this was, I think, and we've kind of danced around it, but the fall of Anakin Skywalker is the hinge of the movie for so many people. And a lot of people came away and they didn't buy that Faustian deal. A lot of people don't necessarily always know that idea of selling your soul to the devil for this forbidden knowledge that you want to save, you know, who you love. And that's, you know, Lucas is using another literary motif here that's older, just as he's using the Camelot idea that's older, that we're not as familiar with, courtly love, all those kind of things. And he knew that people might not love this, but he stuck to his guns and he said, this is where I'm going to go with the story. Kind of wanted to just talk about the fall. And I mean, there's a lot that's really interesting here with the character of Anakin. You know, we've talked a little bit about his control issues. He's a little bit of a control freak. But what are some of the other things that you see kind of going along with this fall that really kind of make it resonate and work for you, or maybe not so much for you?
Well, I think I watched it just the other day, and that's the beauty of the Star Wars movies, is you get something new. You find something in there every time, no matter how many times you watch it, even New Hope. I'm always finding one little thing in there that I go, why didn't I even think of that? Or why didn't I notice that before? And in this movie, this last viewing I saw, when Anakin is on the balcony of Padme, and I guess his place, and she's, you know, brushing her hair, which that scene's, you know, a little awkward, as everything about the relationship is awkward, as we talked about in the last episode. But she says to him, "So love has blinded you?" And that really stood out this time to me, because it's like, yeah, that's the concept of this. I mean, we're talking, is it love or not? I don't know. But it's that obsession of protecting her, and it's that obsession of her and his love for her that has blinded him to what is actually going on and what he should be doing. And so his fall is because of that blindness that is caused by his love for Padme. And every situation in this film, he just falls deeper and deeper. When Mace Windu is out of the picture in that scene, and Anakin is told, "You are now Darth Vader." Pause, right? So that's one step, but I feel like it just continues and continues as he's killing the younglings and the Jedi, and as he sees Padme and Force chokes her, and he's fighting Obi-Wan. It just continues this downward slide throughout the whole film. And that works for me because I don't look at it as like, oh, wow, he quickly became Darth Vader when he saved Palpatine from Mace Windu, and now he's Darth Vader. No, that was yet one more step, one more big step, and he just keeps stepping further and further and further into the dark side to the point when he's in that helmet and that mask at the end, he truly is so far down that road, but there's always a little bit of good in him.
One small step for Sith, one giant leap for Sith kind.
Yeah. Well, I, you know, to get back though to the Padme thing, like their relationship is a parallel for what's happening, because you have Anakin, representative of, you know, the Jedi, the heroes. They're also blind to what's going on. And Padme is that good impulse that's almost in a way like that they have subscribed to, but aren't actually as devoted to as they think that they are. And in terms of people being, you know, the motivations being murky, there are heroes on both sides. Evil is everywhere. I think that is also a very important thing in terms of the fall of the Republic, or any war that you're going to discuss, where it isn't clear cut, because when you have, it's an actual civil war in this, is, and he goes to the lengths of calling the, you know, the rebels in this the Confederacy of Independent Systems. So I've always wondered, is there even a theme about, like, the Confederacy is not justified for going to war. They instigated this. They were behind so much pain and sorrow and suffering and greed. But at the same time, there are still people there who aren't even sure what they're fighting for. You know, and are even removed, just like the Republic is, because their troops are just pawns to them, not actual people. But I think that Padme and Anakin's relationship is the key to understanding what's happening to the Republic, especially through Revenge of the Sith. I just think that it's a parallel for what's going through everything, and the, you know, she calls it out. This war represents a failure to listen, and she wants diplomacy. But Anakin is, no, crush our enemies, destroy, you know, he's like Conan.
It's so interesting because I think you're right on, John. And it's interesting to watch, just talking on the Anakin's guide, we talked about him, you know, his overbearing need for control of everything in his life. And, you know, he says to her, you know, she's like, I'm not going to die in childbirth. And she's like, I promise you. And he's like, no, I promise you. And that Anakin becomes his own worst enemy. He brings about the very thing he swore he'd prevent. And I think that's an interesting parallel. And especially as you were talking about Lucas maybe putting a lot of himself in Anakin. And I thought it was so telling that, you know, when we do everything we can, when we focus all our energy on trying to fight a nightmare, we become the nightmare a lot of times. And that's exactly what Anakin becomes. And it's so interesting because on the other side with Padme, I think Padme really, a lot of people get kind of down about her character in this film, but I think she plays such an important, pivotal role because she is symbolically linked with all that is good in the galaxy still, and it slowly being choked out with her literally and then metaphorically with the galaxy, so that as she dies, all that is beautiful and wonderful about this galaxy is slowly being destroyed. And so that, you know, the OT becomes so stark. It's like as what femininity represents in mythology is being destroyed until we kind of see the return. And you don't get this return until Return of the Jedi, with the green of Endor. And then, of course, Leia being a little bit softer and that return of femininity coming back mythologically. So I think it's a really big amount of symbolism that Padme is portraying. She's so important, so pivotal to this whole arc here. And I think people do a really disservice when they talk about that Padme is not a great character, because I think that she is everything that's good in the galaxy being choked out, and that as she dies, the technological terror is born.
Mm-hmm.
You know, literally and figuratively.
Well, yeah, definitely. And actually, if you'll forgive me, I actually want to talk about the structure of the end of the movie, because it's, I think that it speaks very much to your point that there's the, you know, the whole reason they're showing the way things, you know, go that way is it's not that Vader is literally being worked on as she's dying in childbirth. They're paired up simply for the thematic pairing. You know, it's not meant to show an exact, you know, time and space, but I think that speaks very much to your point that the technological terror being born while the good and the light is dying. And, you know, even thinking of the Death Star as the thing that is born, not even in terms of a technological terror, but this is the child, like Anakin has turned his back on the good and pure life and source of life, and has instead followed that whole, you know, arc of Darth Plagueis, and is with the Death Star, with Palpatine, given birth in a sense to this new horror. You know, this is the family he's embraced over the family he's rejected.
Well, I want to go back to the whole parallels, because Anakin and the Jedi Council are very similar in the fact that Anakin is trying to save Padme. The Jedi Council is trying to save the Republic and Liberty. And as Padme mentions in the Senate, that this is how liberty dies. It's that fear of liberty and the Republic dying, and the Jedi are now blinded. And they want control, just like Anakin wants control of Padme. And in both situations, the Jedi and Anakin lose because that control kills the very thing they're trying to protect. And therefore, when we get into the original trilogy, it's everything's dead. Everything they wanted is dead. And now they're just corrupt. The Empire, the Republic is now the Emperor, the Empire. And Padme is now dead. And as a result of that, we've got Anakin as Darth Vader. They totally screwed everything that they wanted because of what Palpatine did. He twisted everybody and knew that they needed control, and they lost everything.
It's an interesting thing watching the fall of the Republic happen. And, you know, I think that this is one of the best themes of Star Wars, as well as obviously the prequels, is how the Republic gets corrupted into an empire. And then, of course, along with that, there's the smaller story of how two people's decisions bring down Camelot. You know, the way that Lancelot and Guinevere were with each other, the illicitness of their love is what ends up bringing down Camelot in a lot of ways. And in the same sense, Anakin and Padme are kind of the linchpins here. And as they continue down this path of lies and deceit, they're falling into the same thing, the lies and deceit of the Senate, the senators, the Republic itself, the lies of the entire galaxy, of getting into the Civil War with the Confederacy of Independent Systems. That's also a lie. I mean, that everything is built on all of these lies. And of course, it all comes crashing down in the end, because lies are unsustainable. It's one of my favorite things about the Dark Knight trilogy, is that, you know, you end the, what everybody thinks is the greatest of all of them, Dark Knight, but you end it on a lie, And that lie brings everything crashing down by the next film. And it's the truth that sets everybody free. And it's not till people start to know the truth in the original trilogy that it begins to set the galaxy free. You know, when Luke learns about who Darth Vader is as his father, that it starts to set in motion a path that that Luke is going to be on a different path than Obi-Wan and Yoda think he'll be on, which is the redemption of his father, not just the destruction of his father. They can't see that, Yoda and Obi-Wan, because all they can see is the bad. But there's something about the truth that sets something free in Luke to see a path that even those two Jedi can't see. And so I think it's just really interesting here where all the lies finally come crashing down and destroy everything. We are in the middle of election season here, and it's an important thing that we not continue, as the Republic did, to allow lies to continue. That be the framework with which we continue to allow things to be built on, because it will come crashing down. And that's what I like, I think, what Lucas is really driving home here with Episode 3 and the prequel trilogy.
But is there also sort of a, because Lucas is such a student of history, is there almost a fatalist, you know, there's a difference in the tones between the two trilogies. And what's so interesting to me is that Star Wars, now known as A New Hope, came out, you know, on the tail end of Watergate, Studio 54, like crime in New York was nuts. And, you know, the president at the time, you know, said, we're suffering from a great national malaise. And Star Wars shows up and saves the day. Like, people start to be a movie gives them a positive message. I mean, if you look at the sci-fi of the 70s, you know, like Soylent Green and Omega, it's all bummers, man. It's really dark in the 70s. And then Star Wars shows up and blows the lid off.
I can't do that, Dave.
Yeah. Well, that was... Anyway. But the prequel trilogy comes along, and it winds up having this more fatalist sort of thought that, okay, yeah, you know, you saw good times and everything, but you know what? If you want to get back to that, all throughout history, society has to tear itself down before it can fix itself. So if you think things are bad, it's really just going to... Like, are you following me on that? Where it's like, there's this weird reflection in the prequel trilogy that is not in the original trilogy. The original trilogy defied the mood and woke up, you know, this sort of like heroic desire in people to see a better, you know, world and happiness. Whereas the prequels, there's very much a sense throughout the whole thing of, you know, it's gonna suck. So like, I almost wonder if there's a, if it's problematic for audiences because it's more reflective of that mentality than the more hopeful one.
No, I think you're onto something. Obviously, the fall of the Republic is very much based on the fall of Rome. And then I would think that the rise of the rebellion in some ways is akin to kind of the Renaissance appearing, which makes, I'm wondering, the new trilogy, does that make that the World War I, World War II era of history, maybe, next, when we're talking about major conflicts and changes in the course of history at that point?
Yeah, it all depends on if they decide to move forward with the sort of tone poem structure. Like that's the big, you know, to get back to how this movie affected us at the time, I think that a lot of the trepidation that personally, you know, just speaking for me, that I feel coming up on Episode 7 is the fact that Episode 3 did give me that moment of like, it's done. It's over. And now it's not. And it's sort of weird.
I think it was now, you know, it's almost as if you've reopened the wound. before everything had closure, you felt like, okay, I know what happens to these characters. Of course, there was the EU, but you knew where the characters ended up. Everybody ended up kind of in a happy place. But now you're back in that position of, oh, crap, now I have to worry about what happened to Luke, what happened to Leia, what happens to Han, and am I going to like the decisions that they're actually making with the characters? Because before, I can just imagine in my head what happened, and now they're going to actually tell me what happened. It's kind of like...
It's the same bind that the prequels were in. We'd all written the story in our heads.
Yes, a little bit, except I guess it was a little bit easier for me to accept that one. Whereas this one reminds me more of, you know how they keep bringing shows back?
Ah.
You know, like 10 years later?
Yeah.
And kind of ruining them there for you? That's how I kind of feel about, and I was listening to another podcast and they said that, and I thought, that is a great way to put it when you think about them bringing back, you know, the X-Files and all these other shows that are kind of coming back, and it's like, regardless of how they ended, it ended, and I didn't have to worry about the characters anymore.
I'm hoping the new cast is the central cast to the new films. Yeah. Almost like, you know, you're talking about bringing a TV series back. It's one thing to bring the X-Files back with the same characters. It's another thing if you go from Star Trek, the original series, to the Next Generation. Different crew, different situation. Even though we have Luke, Leia, and Han, and Chewie in this next film, there's different parts of me that want to see them be the centralized characters, but if anything, I really think they should just be the bridge to start off this new generation. And I would hope that these films do not try to feel like the original trilogy. I think it's great that the prequel trilogy feels different than the original trilogy. I like to see the sequel trilogy stand on its own and feel different too, because these are all different points in time in this timeline in the Star Wars universe. And I used to view, in a lot of ways, the six films together, the prequel trilogy being like the Old Testament and the original trilogy is the New Testament. Now we got this other trilogy. And you know, the Old Testament and New Testament feel different from each other. Now we've got this other testament. I don't even know what we would even call it now.
I think that you have a real point, though, Bruce, because really the only thing that they need to do is that one of those new cast members has to be a Skywalker. The saga needs to be about the Skywalkers. That's what George always said it was. So that's really all that needs to happen, is that they need to have a connection with the Skywalker family so that the storyline can continue. And yeah, of course, you can have the original cast be there, but that the actual thrust of the movie is more about, you know, that newer generation. And so I think that's a good point. We'll see what happens.
Well, you know, it's interesting though, because we're sitting here, we're all justifiably, I think, like a little trepidatious. We're not quite sure what to expect with the, you know, with the sequel trilogy and everything. But like with Clone Wars slips in and, you know, pours in this, all of this story into the gap between 2 and 3. And I don't recall feeling the same trepidation. Why? You know, because Clone Wars does act as a bridge. It can and does inform certain things, you know, and casts them in a different light, or casts more light on them, you know, from the prequels and everything. What's different about that versus the sequels? Like, I didn't have that same sort of fear. What is it that's different?
Well, because it's not part of the movie saga. I mean, you can lump it in, but it's an animated show. It's on TV. I think it's just because what medium it is, and that would apply to comics and novels and games and so forth. We want it to all fit together. But if it's a movie within the saga and it's an episode, whatever, well, dang, it needs to all like fit and work together perfectly.
So the Clone Wars, if it had stunk, we could have dismissed it more
I think
easily.
So, yeah.
Okay.
And then luckily it didn't stink. I think one of the best things about that is that it shed so much light on the entire prequel trilogy. So I kind of want to dive right into that with you guys. That in light of the Clone Wars, how does it change how you view the prequels and especially Episode 3 with everything that they give us?
Well, I think the clone troopers, to me, have more a human aspect to them because we got to know the characters. Different troopers had different personalities. That made watching the Order 66 more powerful for me after watching the Clone Wars, because I felt like I knew these clone troopers. When I first saw the movie, they were, in a sense, just almost like robots to me. They're all the same people. They're clones. They've switched their goal of protecting the Jedi and fighting alongside them and now killing them because that's how they're programmed to. And then when we get to the Clone Wars series, they address Order 66 and how that was programmed into them. And I had more feelings for these guys because these were heroes. These were each individuals. They had dreams. They had goals. And in a lot of ways, they were slaves too, just like Anakin grew up as a slave and they're a slave of this whole war. And I had a lot more feelings for them into Episode 3.
I think that's a great point. I do think that the clones are where they really, brought to light a lot of themes. I think, of course, Ahsoka, the idea that Anakin had an apprentice between the movies, but that doesn't really change how I've viewed Episode 3. It's very weird. The only thing that's really impacted the way I view Episode 3 are the episodes where they maybe address some things that Episode 3 was expected to address but didn't, such as, Qui-Gon. Because, at the end of Episode 3, it's, oh, hey, Obi-Wan, by the way, just so you know, Qui-Gon's been talking to me, and we're going to teach you how to preserve yourself after death. It's like, oh, surprise.
We got some learning for you, son.
Yeah, right, exactly. Training I have for you while in exile. But I think that the arcs that spoke to the Force and, even some of the intrigue, like, I know that this will sound really lame, but I mean, that I think it was a 4-episode arc in the 6th season that dealt with the financing of the war and how intricate that was.
Yeah.
That was fascinating to me because it was like, oh, wow. Okay. So that's how it all worked. Okay. Like it gave you a chance to see the mechanics behind the scenes that weren't important, honestly, aren't important to a 2-hour film. But are important to the fans to know. Like, how did they get the money for it? And, how did the banking clan figure in? And how did Qui-Gon establish the link? And those sorts of things.
For me, the things that really stand out from the Clone Wars and kind of changed my perspective, I think, a little bit of Episode 3 when I watch it now. One is Anakin. His character is so much richer because of all that he's been through the Clone Wars. I think that so that by the time I'm watching Episode 3, I truly kind of understand his character more and all that he's gone through. When Bruce, you were talking about the ups and the downs and all the deception and lies that Anakin has felt like he's been through, all the ways that he feels like the Jedi betrayed him. The Clone Wars do such a great job of systematically working through all of that so that by the time you get there, he already is on the brink of breaking, and it's easily broken. And I think the fact that an animated show, quote-unquote for kids, gives you such a great representation of the hero who will turn into the villain is fantastic. That's one of the best things that the Clone Wars does, is really flesh out that character of Anakin Skywalker.
I don't discount that, but one of the things that I liked about Episode 3, and I sort of like have this bifurcated mindset when it comes to Episode 3, because it's not just my favorite of the six, it's actually one of my favorite films of all time, is there is and try not to run with this one, but there's a lot in Anakin that, because I don't have that larger arc of, like, you know, specific betrayals or specific things, I'm able to read more of myself into him and his reactions to situations. And so, in a sense, there's, so, you know, with Clone Wars, it's sort of restrictive. He becomes less personally relatable to me as a character. So when I go in to watch episode 3, I sort of take everything from Clone Wars and kind of put it on a shelf, you know, maybe with the exception of the Qui-Gon stuff, because I want to still be able to read in my own self and things that metaphorically speak to me about his character.
No, I think that's, I mean, and that's one of the joys of having all the information, is you can do what you want with it.
Yeah.
And that's the other thing that I really love about the Clone Wars, is just the way that it shows the destruction of the galaxy slowly and surely over time, that everything just keeps descending into hell until you finally get to hell on Mustafar, where the end is coming nigh for, you know, everything. Like, it's over. You know, yeah. The dream is dead. And I love, and I kind of wanted to just talk about that scene. It's just, it's a powerful scene. It's not in the outline. I don't care. this is my show. I'll do what I want. I love the fact that Anakin is standing there on the platform in the lava. He's yelling at Obi-Wan, and Obi-Wan's just telling him, "Don't do it. I'm going to take you down if you do it." And the fact that Obi-Wan literally and figuratively has the high ground is, and the way that the whole scene is done, I know that some people complain that it's just overdone with the imagery of descending into hell, and, you know, Anakin has made the deal with the devil, and now he's paying for it, you know, in the deepest, darkest, you know, level of hell. But I think it just works so much. One, because I think more than not, people need to get slapped in the face these days with imagery because they're not paying attention when they're watching movies. And two, I love the way that everything about that scene happens, so that the guy who has been kind of the person we've been following through the prequels, Obi-Wan, the one we know kind of as the bastion of good and all of that, is standing on the hill, on the high ground, and he has that morally and just literally. And I love that scene. And I think it's probably, you know, of course, then it descends into them yelling at each other again and the heartbreak of Obi-Wan Kenobi. So,
well, I think that you're absolutely right. That scene is wonderful. I love it. But I, you know, there's also, you know, so long as we're going off script, in the novelization, he really gave voice to Obi-Wan's internal conflict. Mm-hmm. And I think it comes across on the screen, but I can't remember the exact wording, but he basically says Obi-Wan realizes during the fight, he's like, he realizes what's wrong is he still loves Anakin, and he has to stop loving Anakin. And that's the only way he can bring himself. Like, he makes the decision, I got to kill him. I can't love him. I have to just tear that out of myself and stop fighting just to defend. But this has got to be over. And then, I mean, you know, if you really think about it, he watches his best friend burn, as he believes, to death. Like, that's just awful. I mean, what a scene.
Yeah, but if you're standing, you know, there with a lightsaber and you're watching your friend burn to death, would you just watch him burn to death, or would you put him out of your misery? That's the one problem I have with that scene. I love the scene. It's just sometimes I think, why would he? I know for story reasons he had to keep him alive, but why not just end him? I mean, he's evil, he's screaming, he's on fire, he's in pain. You could just end his misery now and move on. But instead, he just picks up the lightsaber and says, well, you just keep on burning and feel that.
Well, he's stopped screaming by the time he picks up the saber and walks away, mm-hmm. hasn't he?
He's still kind of groaning.
But I think it's fair to presume he's dead by that point. You know, like,
I think, though, that more so it's thematically what George is trying to do is that Anakin's been hoisted on his own petard. It's all of his choices that have led him to be lying there burning to death. And so that's really kind of the imagery that you're being left with of Anakin's responsible, really, in the end, for being there, you know, without an arm and two legs and a cybernetic arm burning to death because it's his choices that have put him there, not really Obi-Wan's action.
Yeah, but I think to speak to Bruce isn't the first person to bring up, why doesn't he just turn on his lightsaber, walk down and cut off his head and just be sure that it's done? And I think that it is specifically because he's not going to walk down and do that. Like, I think it's a totally fair presumption to be like, well, yeah, he's done for, and I don't really want to go down and dismember a body. So I'm, you know, like, I think that Obi-Wan, even in a practical sense, it makes sense. Like, I'm not going to walk down to the edge of the lava and, you know, risk catching on fire myself. You know, I think it's a fair presumption to be like, he's done. He's over with.
And I always read it as this, is that Obi-Wan leaves it to the Force almost if Anakin dies. Because I like the novelization there, but what I like more is my reading in there is that there's a part of Obi-Wan that still loves Anakin. And he believes he's stopped Anakin and that Anakin will die, but he doesn't want to be the one to put the saber through his head.
Well, the way it was originally scripted, at least, was Obi-Wan was supposed to leave as he saw Palpatine's shuttle arriving. So there was this Palpatine's arriving, and Obi-Wan's like, "Whoop! I got to get out of Dodge," and he runs off. And it was apparently Ewan McGregor who talked Lucas into not doing it that way. He said, we have to leave it where Obi-Wan honestly believes Anakin is dead, and he's not leaving it open-ended like that, you know, and just running away. And I think that is, especially given the other way it could have played, that is, I do think it very much makes sense what he does. And, you know, at least he's not saying, might be dead, but look, Palpatine's here and running off, you know?
So basically, Ewan was trying to set up his own trilogy between the series for when he finds out that, you know, he's still alive. He didn't finish the job.
Oh, that's still the moment I want to see.
Yes, I so want to see that story.
Yeah.
Yeah, where Obi-Wan's like, wait, oh no. You know, like, news eventually reaches out to the Outer Rim and he's on Tatooine. And they're like, oh, did you hear the news? The Emperor's got this new right-hand man. See, he's named Darth Vader. See? And, you know, Obi-Wan's like, his name's what? I'm sorry. I'm going to go back out to the Jundland Wastes then. Thank you.
The easiest answer is that he can't kill him. That's just the point.
Because it's not the Jedi way?
It's not the story. He has to stay alive. So, I mean, it's not Obi-Wan being a jerk. It's just in the end, he can't truly finish off Anakin because he has to be left alive to become Darth Vader. And so I always took it as that, because I always read that into Obi-Wan's character, that no matter what he did, there was a part of him that, and he screams this to him, you were my brother, I loved you. And that's why he will leave it up to nature to take its course for Anakin to die, but he's not going to be the one in the end to, and because if he had wanted to, he could have simply chopped Anakin in half when he but no, the move he does is to cut off his arms and his leg, and Obi-Wan makes a conscious choice to do everything he can to stop him without him, you know.
I don't know if
cutting
I agree.
Off his head.
I don't know if I agree with that. I think that there's a little bit too much exculpation of Obi-Wan in that line of thought. I just go back to, it makes sense. He thinks his friend is dead. He leaves. And there's even a textual moment where Palpatine shows up and there's disbelief in his voice when he goes, he's still alive. You know, like Palpatine thinks he's showing up to pick up a corpse. And he looks down and it's like, I just think I believed, you know, it's still played as if he's dead. And then that shot of just the metallic hand coming up and grabbing onto the gravel, trying to go. And then you hear, and you know, it's like, there is this shock moment. If you're seeing these movies, like I imagine as a kid or something, and you don't know what's going to happen next. Like, I think it really plays as a real, like, whoa, he moved. What happened? So,
yeah, I mean, you might think he's dead and then you see that, like you said, and I can buy all that. The only part I don't buy is, okay, if Obi-Wan thinks Anakin is dead, sure, that makes sense. But wouldn't he feel in the Force that he's still alive?
Well, wouldn't Dooku have felt Obi-Wan spying on him on Geonosis? As we have come to find out, the Force radar doesn't quite work the way we all thought it did from the original trilogy.
Well, and the dark side does cloud things.
Right. Right. Maybe the dark side was masking Anakin and was right. Like, yeah, go. Get out of here. Get out of Dodge.
And I think that it leads again into the Clone Wars and how does, you know, Darth Maul survive and the fact that the dark side keeps him alive. And actually, you know, they described it that the dark side kind of encompassed him and like brought parts to his body to create the spider legs. And so I think that actually does a really good job of showing how Anakin does stay alive, that it is the dark side of the Force that's so strong at that point that has tipped the balance that is keeping this, you know, new Sith alive.
So maybe he did temporarily die and the dark side is so strong it brought him right back.
There you go. Like a little dark side cardiac. What are those little machines that they have at the football stadiums now when you have too many nachos?
A defibrillator?
Yeah, there you go.
A dark side defibrillator?
But there's almost a comic scene, you know, because you brought up Darth Maul. Like there's almost, you could almost write a comic scene where like Obi-Wan finds out that Vader is alive even though he like cut him up and everything. Where he's like, what, again? Why doesn't anybody I cut up stay dead? Like Obi-Wan's got a, you know, 0% track record.
That's
here.
True.
Next time I go for the head.
Yeah. You know, next time I will use a blaster. You know, it's like whatever.
No, for you guys, there are some missing scenes. We talked a little bit about the fact that the Yoda communing with Qui-Gon wasn't there. And then, of course, I think the biggest scene really that got cut was, and there's a bunch. I mean, the fact that they killed Shaak-Ti twice in the deleted scenes and then completely took out her death altogether. Then she could show up again in The Force Unleashed. What did you guys think about the fact that they did take away the whole coalition of senators of the 2000? Mon Mothma was in the film, Padme, Bail Organa leading this charge of holding back Palpatine from gaining more power. And really interesting in that scene, they're talking about the fact that they're not even sure if they can trust the Jedi because they're not sure where the Jedi's loyalties lie. Again, reinforcing that the Jedi shouldn't be involved in political parties or, you know, being sponsored by the government. So maybe George is a big separation of church and state guy. But yeah, what did you guys think about some of those scenes?
I wish the scenes were there, but especially when I saw the deleted scenes, I was hoping they'd come out with, get ready for it, a special edition that had those scenes placed back in. But I'm glad that they're not. I think they're interesting, but I don't think they add that much to the story. I think the movie needs to focus on Anakin and tell Anakin's story and not veer off too much into this other piece of it. It would have been nice to see a little more about Padme. It adds a little more to her story, but I don't think it adds anything to move anything really to the film.
There is only one scene, and it's like half a scene, that I would really want added back in, and it's what leads up to Palpatine saying he's putting him on the Jedi Council. It's a scene, the front half of that scene that was edited out, is Anakin is standing behind the Chancellor the way that Vader is going to stand by the Emperor, and Padme and Bail and a few other people are like presenting a case to Palpatine about, you know, reopening diplomacy and everything like that. And Palpatine, of course, is telling him to go pound sand. And Padme shoots a look at Anakin, like, you know, say something. And Anakin actually looks down and away, like, I don't know what to say. And then they leave. And then it goes right into, you know, I hope you trust me, Anakin. And, you know, he appoints him as his personal representative on the Jedi Council. Like, that, it's such a small snippet of time. Now, the movie still works without it, but it's just that that's the one thing I would like added back in.
Well, I think I would like personally to have seen a little bit more with this coalition of senators, because what I think it does is that it makes Padme asking the question later on to Anakin about maybe we're on the wrong side, seem like it's coming from more than just nothing, you know? I really think that that means a lot more. And then, of course, when you truly see Padme sitting there in the council chambers as, you know, Palpatine is elaborating this plot about the Jedi, and she says, "This is how liberty dies," to thunderous applause. And you can tell that it is Padme who is all that was good and kind of righteous and whatnot about the Republic still. And all of that, again, is slowly being squelched out by Palpatine and his machinations. And I think it would have just added a little bit more depth to her character, but also to the discussions that she has with Anakin, and just give them a little bit more weight. So again, they're not really long scenes, but a couple of them interspersed in there I thought would have been just, for me, it would have strengthened some of what George was already doing. And that's just kind of how I felt about it, especially when I watch specifically that one scene there.
Fair enough.
Well, the last one, you know, because of the Clone Wars, we did get the Yoda arc where he got to commune with Qui-Gon, and Qui-Gon led him to the priestesses that taught him all that he was going to need to know to begin on the journey. So the scene we lost with Yoda communing with Qui-Gon there doesn't seem so much of a loss at this point. But I remember when the movie first came out and I saw that scene and it wasn't there, I was a little bit disappointed because I had heard rumors of it, and then when it wasn't there, and then, of course, we had the novelization, and it was there. I really liked that. Now it's not as bad in light of the Clone Wars, but beforehand, it was like, oh, man, that would have been so cool.
It was such a bummer that that wasn't there. That was the thing I was the most disappointed about, and I heard or I assumed that Liam Neeson wasn't available or didn't want to do it or whatever. And I thought, man, it's too bad he didn't step up and do that. I guess he wasn't interested or available. And then to see him do it in the Clone Wars, I was like, well, wait, if he's going to show up to a cartoon series, he certainly could have showed up to the movie. Come on. Why wasn't that in the movie? So if that out of the whole saga, that's the one thing I would really wish that would have been added into any piece of the saga, is that scene of Qui-Gon communing with Yoda. But it's great that's in the Clone Wars. That helps make up for that. But, I mean, we see a hint of it in Attack of the Clones. So, you know, it's okay. But I wish it were there.
Yeah, you can live without it. I wish it were there as well. I remember reading rumors, at least back at the time, that there was some bad blood between Liam Neeson and George Lucas.
Whoa, whoa, whoa. Like Taylor Swift and Katy Perry kind of bad blood?
Those are English words. I have no idea what you said. So I think that that might have contributed, and maybe that wound had healed. But I remember that Liam Neeson had made some dismissive comment about the ridiculousness of the movies and or something like that back when before episode two came out, where basically, you know, like a reporter started, you know, everybody's favorite game between episode one and episode three was to get some actor that had or somebody who had had a tie to, you know, episode one to in some way say something that, you know, confirmed their opinion or something. But I do think that that might have contributed. Or, I mean, maybe Liam Neeson was just like, nah, I don't want to do it.
Or, you know, George Lucas looked at it and said, it's not needed because I need Yoda to tell Obi-Wan about it. So why see it and then hear Yoda explain it to Obi-Wan?
No, I was going to say, I think that you could make an argument for it not being in there because that moment, I remember seeing it the first time, that moment when Yoda says, you know, he says, you know, Master Obi-Wan, you know, something, please stay, something more I have to tell you. And he says, you know, your old master. And Obi-Wan lights up and he goes, Qui-Gon? Like, as a fan and as an audience member, like, I perked up like that. It really is a nice surprise moment. Whereas if you had heard Qui-Gon before, it wouldn't have been a surprise, like, as surprising to have that moment. So I guess you could argue your way into saying it's not as necessary as we fans might feel.
Right. It wouldn't be a great gift to us fans to see that. But I honestly think George said, no. I don't think I need it. I think it just slow it down. I think we just need to keep the pace going.
Yeah.
Well, and then, you know, in the end, it all turned out all right because I think it worked so well in the Clone Wars there with the Yoda arc. And you hear Qui-Gon again, I mean, we've already heard him in the Mortis arc. It just shows how powerful Qui-Gon is and important he is. And again, that's one of those things that really changes my viewing of all of the prequels in light of the Clone Wars, but specifically episode 3 is just how important Qui-Gon is to all of this somehow. And I love that there's still a bunch of shrouded mystery around that, but at the same time, it's very clear that Qui-Gon had a very special role to play in his death. As Yoda says, it's not something to be mourned, but something to be celebrated, you know. And he was the first one to teach, you know, the Jedi, especially Yoda. And then, of course, it will be Obi-Wan. But that death is just the next step, you know. And in the Star Wars universe, that's a huge revelation as the Sith are fully, you know, invested in finding a way to be immortal.
Yeah.
And yet it's the Jedi and their selflessness that find that that's the way to immortality.
Right. If Anakin had just been more patient, he would have found the answer. He didn't need to do what he did to find the answer. And as we're sitting here talking about this, and maybe this plays into episode 7, maybe not. Did anybody think to teach Luke that trick?
Oh, yeah.
Like, was it in Obi-Wan's journal where it was like read first and it's like circled like 100 times, like with arrows?
It's highlighted.
This is the important one right here.
Well, no, but I mean, that's one of the things we do have to remember is that the one of the reasons with merging in the Force is so that your consciousness was still there and you could influence the next generation. The EU is out now, so Luke could have spent years communing with Qui-Gon and Anakin and Obi-Wan and Yoda, learning about the ways of the Force. And that's what I think is so interesting, because that kind of thing can actually happen, whereas in the EU, that never really got to happen very much because it was something that they kind of had to retcon out by saying, oh, well, he can only show up a few times. And he's...
No, I want to see that in the next film or in the next trilogy.
Exactly,
I want to see some connection to Qui-Gon, or at least Luke acknowledge that he's been studying the teachings of Qui-Gon, because it's Qui-Gon that later taught Yoda and Obi-Wan when they are in exile. And now you know, if Luke is in exile or whatever, I would love to see that it's the teachings of Qui-Gon that has brought this new philosophy, this new way, this new Jedi type of... There's the old type of Jedi, this is the new type of Jedi, and it's a result of Qui-Gon.
So you're saying that Qui-Gon brings the new wave of Jedi?
Yes.
I think you'd be getting your hopes up because of the specific moment that J.J. Abrams said that he only considered the original trilogy as quote-unquote canon when he was writing Episode 7. So I don't think that we're going to get any Qui-Gon love at all. And that is heartbreaking to me to say as well. But I don't think that there will be that strong a tie to the prequels in there.
Well, we'll see.
I hope I'm wrong. I honestly do.
I hope
maybe one of the books that takes place between Jedi and Force Awakens, maybe that's how they'll address any fan desires.
Well, all I can say, John, it wouldn't be the first time you were wrong.
No, that's true. It would be the second time because shortly before we started recording, I talked about what a pleasant and nice person you were, Bruce. So you're right. That's two wrong in the last hour and a half.
Well, at least you admit. At least you admit your mistakes.
If y'all are going to fight, take it outside. Ruby doesn't like the smashed up chairs. Well, okay. So what would you rate Revenge of the Sith?
It's one of my favorite films of all time. Period and end of sentence. It's not just my favorite of the six. It is one of my favorite of all time. And, you know, there are a lot of factors that go into that for any person. There, you know, it's more than just the film sometimes that informs what your favorite films are.
It's more than a feeling.
Basically. But yeah, if I were to be told in some bizarre, weird, hypothetical world that we all like to throw ourselves into when we have these ridiculous sorts of premises, if I were told you can only show one of the six to somebody and they will never, ever see any of the others, this would be the one I would show.
Ooh, that's very interesting. I don't know if I could say that or not. I'd have to think. If I could only show one, which would it be? Maybe this one, but I, as someone who grew up with the original trilogy, saw the first movie come out in 1977, I'm going to have to say that, episode 3, yeah, it's my favorite of the six. And I don't think you'll hear many people say that who from that generation, but it's so compact with so much drama, so much story, so much of everything. It's just so compact with so much. I mean, the beginning of the film, it's lighthearted, it's fun, it's a fun adventure, and then it becomes dark and it's all depressing, and then it ends with this hope and this light. There's so much emotion and there's so much at play that out of the six movies, it is my favorite until we see what comes out later.
Oh man. Well, nobody's given a rating, but I'm going to give one, and I'm just going to give one Obi-Wan Kenobi. I think that speaks volumes for me. I love episode 3. It is not my favorite, but it is my second favorite Star Wars movie and probably the one that I have seen the most next to Empire Strikes Back. And I'm with you, Bruce. I love the themes of this movie. I love how much it is trying to say. I love that each time I watch it, there's something different and interesting. And I love the way that it wraps up the prequel trilogy on such a solid note. You know, even people who didn't like the prequels reach episode 3 and are like, yeah, that episode 3 is pretty good. You know, it's just hard to argue with how good episode 3 is. And, I have never sat down and talked the saga like this. And it's been fascinating to get to do it, especially as we're leading up to episode 7. And, really kind of diving in and seeing where the themes take us, and specifically talking through 1 through 6, and of course on the way to 7, how those themes will progress. So what I'm really interested to see, as we talked about tonight, okay, once we get to episodes 4, 5, and 6, are there any continuation of themes, or does it really just feel like a new set of themes? And so I'm really excited to get to continue to do that. And so it's going to be great. We have some special guests next time with us. I'm very excited to bring on from the Star Wars Report podcast. Bethany and Riley Blanton are going to be with me and John. And Bruce is sporting their t-shirt. They're great, great fans. They have their own podcasting network. Fantastic. And I can't wait to get to talk to them. Kids of the Prequels, about the original trilogy and Star Wars itself. So I think it's going to be a ton of fun because John and I represent the old generation and they represent the new generation. And I think it's going to be a blast. So make sure to stay with us here in the 602 Club as we continue our Star Wars retrospective, working towards that awakening that you felt. I know you felt it. So I'm so glad you guys have been through the prequel trilogy with me, and it's been an honor to talk the prequel trilogy with both of you. Guys, remember that you can find all the shows on iTunes at itunes.com/trekfm, and of course, make sure you do leave us that. Well, John, what should they leave us on iTunes?
A 5-star review. That's okay. I actually think that for this podcast, iTunes has done away with everything else. You can only give it 5 stars.
Well, I hope so. And I appreciate that is what everyone has given us so far out of the 35 reviews and ratings we have. It is 5 stars. I really appreciate all the people who take the time out to go do that. And you will be rewarded if you do give us a written review. You'll be entered to win a $50 gift card and a USS Vengeance Eagle Moss there at the beginning of October. So make sure you do that. Another really important thing here for the network is we're a listener-supported network, which means that it's really listeners like you that keep this network running. You can check out everything at patreon.com/trekfm and see the ways that you can help the network keep coming to you each week. Really want to thank Ken Tripp for his support of the network and helping bring the 602 Club to you each week by being an associate producer. That's one of the perks that comes with some of the levels there on Patreon, as well as the Patreon Roundtable, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on the content development team, and so much more. Again, you'll find all the details of the ways that you can help us here on the network at patreon.com/trekfm. And of course, a special thanks to my executive producers, Norman Lau and Christopher Brian Jones. Guys, if you would like to contact us, I'd love to get some emails about what you think about Episode 3. Do that at trek.fm/contact. You can leave us a voicemail, look in the sidebar on the show page, or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. We're on Twitter at trekfm, and of course, Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. Bruce, tell everybody about the Babel Conference we have.
Well, the Babel Conference is a closed group on Facebook where people who listen to Trek FM are the people who participate. So unless you listen to Trek FM, if you don't listen to Trek FM, you wouldn't know about the Babel Conference. So it's specifically to those listeners of Trek FM that know about the group. You go in there and you ask to be a member of the group. You get permission to come in and we discuss everything from Star Trek to other things such as Star Wars or any other franchises. It's just a great place and a safe place to talk about things without a whole lot of muckety muck from some other places that you go to.
Yeah, definitely. We'll check everything out at Facebook. You can type Babel into the search field there in Facebook, or if you go to our website at trek.fm, just click discussion on the menu bar and it'll bring you there. You guys are just awesome. And, you know, this show wouldn't be what it is without the guests that come on it. And I'm so glad that we got to finish out the prequel trilogy. Bruce, before we go, let everybody know where they can find you online and, you know, contact you if they want to talk something Star Wars or anything else.
Yes, I'm on Twitter at @Admiral_Rex. And, of course, I'm in the Babel Conference. And I've also started writing for StarWarsReport.com. And as of this week, I can say that I am a new permanent co-host of Cloud City Casino podcast, which is part of the Star Wars Report family of podcasts. And yeah, so, hey, yay, you can listen to me weekly.
Oh, I'm sorry. That should be yippee.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, and real quick, I just want to say about Riley and Bethany when they talk A New Hope. And yeah, they're part of the prequel generation. I had the pleasure about 2 years ago, I think, seeing A New Hope on the big screen with them at a theater in Atlanta that was replaying awesome. It. So it was really cool to sit there and watch it with them. And we discussed it afterwards. So I'm really curious to hear what they say on the show.
I'm really excited as well. So I think it's just going to be a blast to get to talk about Star Wars with them after listening to them for so long. So I'm honored that they did say yes. John, before we go, you've got some things to tell everyone. You've got a few places online that people need to be checking you out. And of course, a few 5-star podcasts yourself, my friend.
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie, KESSELJUNKIE. Or at KesselJunkie.com. And you can also find me elsewhere on the Trek FM network on Commentary Trek Stars that I'm on with the wonderful, delightful Mike Schindler. We feel it's a 5-star podcast as well. And then, of course, I'm on a podcast with my good friend Craig called Words with Nerds, which is also locatable on the iTunes and the Stitcher and the like.
Oh, awesome. Can I say one thing real quick? I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I'm going to be at Dragon Con in Atlanta.
Woo!
The weekend of Labor Day.
So you can pick up my Parsec.
Oh, cool.
That's right. Exactly. I can. I will definitely represent. So please come to the Star Wars room. And, of course, Star Trek has its own track there. But I will be on a couple panels that are Star Wars related. I'm also playing the Emperor in the William Shakespeare's The Jedi Doth Returns.
Nice.
So I'm working on that.
Excellent.
I'm working on that voice and everything.
We need somebody to Periscope that ASAP.
Yeah.
Yeah. That needs to be broadcast live
All
on
right,
the internet.
We'll find out how we can do that.
Okay. Man, oh gosh, everybody's so much cooler than I am. Well, you know, if you want to talk to the uncool one, I'm on Twitter at MattRushing02. I'm also on Instagram at MRushing. I talk about Deep Space Nine with Christopher Jones on The Orb. Definitely the best Star Trek show out there, and I hope you'll check that out and listen to us. We have a blast talking about Deep Space Nine. You can also find me on Literary Treks with Dan Gunther talking about the books and comics of Star Trek, as well as interviewing the authors. We just had a fantastic interview with David Mack, and one of the most personal that we've ever had with an author. So a lot of fun. And I have my own personal blog at 42lifeinbetween.wordpress.com. Well, thank you everyone for joining us, and may the Force be with you. We'll be right back.